this season of Tree Speech, we are focusing on how we commune with trees, the conversations we have with them, as well as the spiritual, mythical, and personal ways people relate to them, not only in our present day, but also throughout history. Appearing in numerous religious and sacred texts, art, literature, science, religion, philosophy, and mythology across faiths, cultures, and civilizations, we couldn't explore our relation to trees without examining the Tree of Life. The Tree of Life, sometimes referred to as the World Tree, appears in mythology and folklore of cultures around the world and varies slightly from culture to culture. A common theme that is shared, however, is the idea that a mystical tree connects the spiritual and physical worlds. In addition, the Tree of Life is foundational to supporting all life on this planet. My name is Dori Robinson, and this is Tree Speech, a podcast where we practice hearing the forest through the trees. This week's episode was written and recorded in Massachusetts, on the native lands of the Wabanaki Confederacy, Penacook, Massachusetts, and Pawtucket people, in New York on the land of the Lenape tribes, as well as on the lands of the Confederate tribes of the Siletz Indians and the Grand Ronde Cowlitz. Tree Speech is co-written and produced by Jonathan Zoutner and Alight Theater Guild. Swiss psychologist Carl Jung continually noticed that trees often arose in people's dreams, and so began to study the commonalities of this occurrence. Through his research, he discovered that trees were part of the collective unconscious, indicating growth, unfolding, shelter, nurturing, permanence, rootedness, and rebirth, and concluded that the tree is an archetype, a symbol deeply ingrained, even hardwired, into the human unconscious. The fact that this ancient symbol for life is a tree is fitting. After all, throughout history, human beings have always paid homage to trees. Our distant ancestors clearly understood how important trees were for supporting life on Earth, even before the times of scientific inquiry. The connections between trees, religion, and spirituality date as far back as humankind, with deep ties in every culture, faith, and civilization. Jewish, Christian, Islamic, Buddhist, Hindi, Mayan, and Celtic interpretations, just to name a few. The oldest known example of the Tree of Life depicted in art was found in excavations in Turkey dating back to 7000 BC, specifically figures of pine trees depicted on vases and potteries. What makes it particularly interesting is that pine trees have been used in art and ceremonies by other civilizations, including the Romans, since they are evergreen and seem to have eternal life. There are many references to the Tree of Life throughout ancient cultures as an imago mundi, meaning the image of the world. For example, in Nordic mythology, the Tree of Life was massive and grew out of the Well of Urd, which was an endless pool that held universal wisdom and other powerful cosmic forces. Known as the Yggdrasil tree, its roots and branches held the nine worlds of the cosmos together. In fact, it was so important that the well-being of the entire world depended on the tree's own vitality. The Norse god Odin wanted to possess the knowledge contained in the Yggdrasil tree and the Well of Urd. Thus, to demonstrate his loyalty to this quest, after sacrificing his eye and throwing himself on his spear, he hanged himself from a branch, nearly dying in the process. However, in the end, he survived, gaining the knowledge of the universe. Greek mythology has a few different stories about magical trees, which closely resemble the idea of the Tree of Life. In one story, Zeus marries the goddess of the earth, Gaia, and from their union, a giant oak tree sprouts. In other versions, as in the story of Osiris, Zeus becomes part of the tree. As with other Tree of Life stories, the roots of the Greek's world tree were said to reach Tartarus, the Greek underworld, and its branches could reach the stars. In another myth, the earth goddess Gaia planted a magical apple tree in Hera's garden as a wedding gift when she married Zeus. Like other world trees, Hera's apple held parts of the universe together. At first, Hera appointed some nymphs to tend to the tree. However, they proved unreliable, so Hera got a dragon named Lothan to guard the tree. What's especially compelling about this story is the similarity between Hera's apple tree and the tree in the Garden of Eden. The Bible begins with the story of the Tree of Life as one of the two trees in the middle of the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve ate not of the Tree of Life, but of the Tree of Knowledge of good and evil. Because they ate of this tree, humankind was expelled from the Garden of Paradise and separated from the Tree of Life, lest they also eat from the Tree of Life and live forever. In Judaism, the Tree of Life is seen as a source of life-giving, representing the knowledge to live peacefully within the wider world. Thus, the Torah is called the Tree of Life, Eitz Chaim in Hebrew, offering a philosophy that makes life understandable and harmonious. The Quran's version of the Garden of Eden story mentions a single tree, the tree of eternity, and the kingdom that faileth not. Because they make the mistake of eating from the tree, Allah sends Adam and Eve to earth, where they must live and learn to repent from their mistakes. However, Allah assures them that while on earth they will have guidance. Thus, the tree of immortality in the Quran represents repenting and learning from one's mistake, as well as God's mercy. The early Irish believed that the Tree of Life was in the direct center of Ireland, in County Westmeath. In this way, the tree was viewed as an axis mundi, the center of the world. Similar to the Aboriginal Australians and other ancient cultures, the Celts were animists. They believed the natural world was interconnected and that spirits inhabit everything, from trees to river, lakes, mountains, and animals. The Celts depended greatly on trees for shelter, building materials, food, shade, and even weaponry. Central trees in a community were where political and spiritual ceremonies were held. The ancient Celts also believed that empty space on a piece of ceremonial jewelry, weaponry, or drinkware allowed evil spirits to enter the artifact. This led to the development of intricate knotwork, swirls and patterns that echoed nature. One of the earliest and most used was the Tree of Life, and these artistic styles are still seen today. Buddhism has a strong connection to the Tree of Life. Once Buddha sat beneath the Bodhi tree and received enlightenment, this tree has now been known as the Tree of Wisdom. In Buddhism, the Tree of Life symbolizes personal development, uniqueness, and individual beauty. Just as the branches of a tree strengthen and grow upwards to the sky, we too may grow stronger, striving for greater knowledge, wisdom, and new experiences as we move through life. So, how do we in our present day connect with trees and gain strength and wisdom from them? We cannot speak directly with them and ask for guidance, can we? Today's guest, Dr. Stephanie Kaza, has spent much time in conversation with trees and has authored a beautifully written and illustrated book to help and inspire others to do the same. An author, scientist, and educator, Dr. Kaza is Professor Emerita of Environmental Studies at the University of Vermont. Also, a longtime practitioner of Soto Zen Buddhism with training at Green Gulch Zen Center, California, and further study with Thich Nhat Hanh and others, she is the author and editor of many books, including Green Buddhism, Practice and Compassionate Action in Uncertain Times. In her book, Conversations with Trees, Dr. Kaza used her background in spirituality and ecology to write autobiographical essays about her encounters with trees. It was such a pleasure to speak with Stephanie. Her spiritual connection to trees and life work as an educator and advocate is awe-inspiring, and she has much wisdom to share. Let's listen. Well, Well, first of all, Stephanie, I just want to thank you so much for being with us today. I know you're a very busy person. Thank you for carving out the time.
It's really a delight. People that love trees are my people.
That means we're your people. So that's wonderful. We are very curious about the intersections of spirituality and trees. And as someone whose work explores the intersection of religion and ecology, can you tell us how this journey began for you?
Well, I could say that it was through reading a book or teaching a class, but honestly, I better start with the first key tree teachers in my backyard growing up. So first in Buffalo, New York, there was a generous, gracious apple tree right in the backyard, and I was lucky enough to have a bedroom with a little deck off it that was right next to the apple tree. So I spent hours out there just watching the light and the shadows when I was like 5 and 6. And I will say I'm extremely happy to be living now in Portland, Oregon, with a big apple tree right outside the window where I'm sitting. But then I also, as I became a teen, I was here in the Pacific Northwest, and there was a big ravine behind our house, and it was filled with Douglas firs. And there, I often walked the trails down by those Doug firs, but at the very base of them by the creek was a stand of 5 giant redwood sequoias. And that became a really important place of pilgrimage through my teens, because it felt like a refuge, a place of stability. And again, I'm not sure that I could have told you what the trees were teaching me. I just knew that was a really good place to be, that it felt safe, and that those trees meant a lot to me. So the trees were first before Buddhism, though I did spend a good chunk of my teenhood also part of going to a church. So I'll give them some credit too, the Unitarians. And I mostly did it through music at that time. So music was a very important expression. And when I went away to college, I went to Oberlin College, where I could sing in the choir and also be a biology major. It was the perfect combination. But that experience of choral singing, I think, developed a sense of resonance at a vibrational level for me that is part of the way I relate to trees today. And I'm still singing in a choir. I really feel the human voice is a marvelous counterpart to the voices, you know, of all the other beings, trees and birds and so on. Now, I was lucky to be at Oberlin spiritually because it had a long theological tradition and also a very strong activist tradition. And I was there in the 60s, very formative time, demonstrations in the streets. I grew up really fast. But what came through all this time and into my Buddhism was that spirituality and activism and engagement all go together. They're not separated. So as I went into my 20s, I had been a biology major. I came to California. I learned all kinds of natural history. I was birding and botanizing, teaching outdoors. I had a long 5 years with the Point Reyes Bird Observatory and then the UC Berkeley Botanic Garden as their education director. So I was teaching people all about the natural world. And I did go on to finish a PhD in biology. But in the middle of all that, my modern dance teacher said, "You should come to Naropa. I think you'd really like it." So I went to Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. And I thought I would just hang out and go to poetry classes with Allen Ginsberg and take dance class with Lee Worsley. It was an amazing time. And along the way, I learned to meditate. And I really took to it. It was just the most natural embodiment, perhaps of not just breathing, but of my understanding of tree-ness. So I returned to Santa Cruz, and then I went to live for a year on the land. I had to go do my hippie thing. But when I returned from making a lot of compost, I came to live at the Santa Cruz Zen Center. And there I met my ordination teacher, Kobun Chino. So my introduction to Buddhism was very filled with an experience of the arts and of a kind of spontaneity. So I really took to Zen, which has that kind of flavor. And Kobun himself is quite a poet, a musician. He played the flute. He was a calligrapher. And he was a very affirming and accepting teacher. And you won't be surprised to hear this, but the rural retreat center that he was associated with, Jikoji, was above the hills of Palo Alto, and he was just fine with us sitting on the outdoor deck outside the Zendo, surrounded by bay trees. So I often did that or did walking meditation on that outdoor deck. And in fact, the very first tree piece I wrote for Conversations with Trees was written there by the pond at Chikoji. So this is a longish story, but I did go on to do a degree with Star King School for the Ministry and taught environmental ethics there. And there brought those Unitarian students out to meet my trees, of course. And it was just my good fortune that as I started teaching at University of Vermont, the entire field of religion and ecology had just kind of burst open. It took a long time to arrive. And I came with environmental ethics and all this Buddhist training. But suddenly people wanted someone who could speak to Buddhist philosophy and address environmental concerns. So I just got on the bandwagon very early on. Lucky for me.
Lucky for you and lucky for us. Thank you for sharing all that richness. It really sounds as though your journey with trees and your journey with Buddhism really intertwined so spontaneously, but also naturally. Now we're going to focus on your book, Conversations with Trees, mm-hmm. within which you have a chapter called Magnetic Presence, in which you write, "Some part of me is tree." Can you expand on this concept of being one with trees or a part of you being tree?
So being one with trees, an easy thing to say, but what does it really mean? In Zen Buddhist philosophy, there's a very strong emphasis on non-dualism, no separation between self and other. Any sense of separation or overinflation of you, me, mine, I is seen as a kind of delusion. Another way to think about that is Thich Nhat Hanh's word, interbeing. People really like that because it gives you a sense of connection, relationship, but it's always going on. His very famous meditation is about holding up a piece of paper and asking students to see the sky in the paper, see the water, see the soil in that piece of paper. So we say the phrase, not one, not two. It's kind of a koan. So it's not, I am me and there is a tree over there, but there's something going on, you know, between us. The way I'm describing it these days is that I feel I'm part of a tree tribe, and in particular, the conifers of the Pacific Northwest. And I'm so happy to be back among my people again after 24 years of being in Vermont. So I see, for example, Douglas fir as a strong and stern kind of elder teacher, whereas Western red cedar is a warm and loving presence. I have visited an old growth grove of Sitka spruce on the coast since I was a kid. And I've been going back quite a bit since we moved back to Oregon. And I've decided that I want to just offer my remains to that particular forest so that whatever is left will indeed finally become part of that forest.
That's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. You mentioned this concept of ecological sanity. Can you tell us what ecological sanity means to you and why it is important?
Well, usually when we use the word sanity, we're thinking about mental and physical health, emotional health, spiritual health. So you would infer ecological sanity is then about healthy relations with the ecological realms that support our human lives and, of course, support all the other beings in the world who deserve and need our respect. And I'm sorry to say, as a planetary people, we're mostly acting in quite ecologically insane ways, ignoring the wisdom of indigenous peoples, of scientists, and of the world religions. There are different ways of describing this insanity in kind of psychological terms. Some call it an addiction to fossil fuels, to consumerism, for example, or you might say it's a kind of narcissism, thinking only of ourselves or ourselves first, human lives is dominant on the whole planet. And some religious teachings reinforce that. Or you could say it's a kind of forgetfulness that we're just so absorbed in our lives that we forget everything else that's going on. So all of those are ways of being kind of a little insane. And when you add them all up together, the impact is of a world that is going crazy. It's going crazy in its ecological systems, and the human, political, and economic systems are not strong enough to restore that ecological sanity in a unified way right now. There's very destructive things going on in our major forests of the boreal lands, as well as the Amazon. And of course, war is never good for ecological systems. So why ecological sanity is important boils down to it's the only way we will survive on this earth. But I will say at the very same time, there is a deepening sense of ourselves as planetary people. And there's a deepening sense that ecological sanity is possible and necessary, and that it really requires us to use our spiritual practices to focus on what I'll call out three things here as a kind of part of our closing, to focus on healing our relationships with trees, with each other, just stop cutting them, stop burning them, stop murdering them, and with the land, and start working on the great course correction after these 100 years, 200, 300 years of plunder and extraction and genocide. So healing is one great need, building community and practicing community, understanding ourselves as part of forest, part of neighborhood, part of the planet. And this shift I see happening more and more everywhere, that is very, very encouraging. And both of these, I would say, are about practice, what we do every day, how we show up, how we pay attention, how we choose to take ethical action, working with others, engaging in ritual and ceremony, but always returning. And this is a very important Buddhist theme. The daily practice of meditation or chanting or walking, so that Buddhist practice informs your path to ecological sanity.
That was really wonderful how you laid that out for us in such a connected way. In Conversations with Trees, it was originally released in 1993. Does the book have resonance today that is different from when it was first released? And what is it like for you to go back to the stories and chapters in the book with years of life experience since it was originally published?
Honestly, it is a thrill. When I reread those stories, I think every word is true. That absolutely happened. I can remember it in my body. They somehow have really held up. And I, especially one of the best stories of the whole project is that when I decided I really wanted an artist for the book, I thought it would just make the book so much better. I was lucky enough to meet a person at an Engaged Buddhism meditation retreat right before I moved to Vermont. And he and I were both, of course, had been sitting all week long. So we're on some kind of wavelength, though I'd never met him before. And he said, well, I might have the kind of drawings you're looking for. And he sent me a package and I fell in love right there. And that's our love story. And today now, Davis and I have been married 23 years and he is still drawing trees. And I'm thrilled to have his drawings in the book. And we really just decided the trees brought us together. But we can celebrate all that so much more today because we're not hiding in a closet with it. When I would do readings back then in the 90s, people would sneak up to me afterwards and say, oh, I have a favorite tree. Can I tell you about my tree? And they didn't want to talk too loud because they thought people would think they were crazy. But now it's everywhere. It's in the popular lexicon now. And there's so much more awareness of trees, the importance of tree planting for urban cooling, as well as aesthetics. So I think the book really holds up well, and I'm glad it's in the company of other tree books. It has some friends on the shelf. In fact, we have one whole bookshelf that's nothing but tree books in our house. I'm thrilled that Shambhala wanted to re-release it again, and I know their decision was because there's so much more receptivity and interest right now in the general population.
My producer and I both also have shelves of tree books. What an incredible story that love of trees brings so many people together. What trees are calling to you right now?
Well, I'm really feeling it in spring. It's so exciting. It's like the tree energy is really awakened, like there's just surging energy between everything. It's really coursing out there. And I have a feeling I'm supposed to be doing some more writing about trees. And so they are talking to me. And the one that I met recently is an enormous Western red cedar. It's called the Rockaway Cedar. It's on the coast in Oregon, just north of Tillamook, Oregon. And it's a remnant old cedar, hundreds of years old, enormous in scope. And it was kind of in a little backwater behind a neighborhood, and people were just kind of creeping in on various paths here and there to see it. And it was annoying the neighbors so much that finally they decided to build a boardwalk through the cedar swamp out to this beautiful cedar. So when I visited this cedar, my first meeting, oh, I was so excited. All along the way on the boardwalk were blooming skunk cabbage, just brilliant yellow, right and left, right, and hundreds of them. So I was hitting a peak moment energetically in this spring swamp. And I was already very excited by the time I got to the cedar and looking at different cedars along the way. Is this it? Is this it? And then when I got to the big one, I just couldn't move for a while. I stayed, I don't know, an hour or more. And I knew the message was, you have to write about cedars. I'll give you all the information you want. Just keep coming back to me. Don't ever forget that I'm here for you. And I will give you the energy you need to complete what you're supposed to be doing now. It was so, I'm saying it in words, but words are not really the way it was coming through. Obviously, trees don't speak English, but it came kind of through the heart. And part of what it enabled me to do was sort of look at what else was coming to me. Like, where else am I picking up very faint clues or little seeds somewhere out there in the cosmos?
And I can't wait to hear through you what the trees are saying and what the trees are sharing. Thank you so much for joining us today, Stephanie. We are so inspired by the seeds you've planted towards action. And that is both inward and outward, towards a deeper understanding of ourselves and towards healing and creating more sustainable lives for one another. And we look forward to all the wisdom and beauty forthcoming from you as well. Thank you.
You're really welcome. I'm thrilled that you're doing this, and I wish you all the luck in the world. I hope you get a wide, wide listenership.
As you said at the beginning, we're hoping to find more of our people, more of our tree people, and to share with others how they're tree people, whether they realize it or not.
Wonderful.
I was struck by the clarity Stephanie has when she speaks about and with trees. She knows them on a biological level, but also views the world holistically. Her stories center around trees as living, sentient, though sedentary, beings, and find ways to converse with them by giving those interactions space and time. It takes a lot of effort and patience to understand a human on many levels. So too with a tree. Carol Cusack, professor of religious studies at the University of Sydney, wrote that the powerful and evocative place that trees hold in the human imagination, which is apparent in religious and spiritual contexts, is due to their kinship with human beings. Their substitutability is due to their being different, yet continuous with humans, in that they both share life. This is the work that Stephanie does, to make it clear that trees are alive, worthy of large myths and religious symbolism, and also our personal, intimate relation to them in our everyday lives. In her book, Conversations with Trees, Stephanie writes, quote, "Trees have historically and mythologically represented many things. The tree of life, the axis of the earth, tribal ancestors, home of spirits. But my efforts here, awkward as it feels at times, is to try to speak directly with trees." She continues, quote, "In these meetings of trees and person, I allow myself to see and also be seen by trees. As in most good conversations, there is the desire for more contact, more time together, and more depth. To cultivate this opportunity will require a level of love, effort, and spiritual integrity that I can only just begin to imagine. Stephanie has put in that love and effort over years to develop her own relationships with trees. What would you like to speak to a tree about? What do trees mean or symbolize to you? And how about the Tree of Life? Does it hold meaning for you at this time? I've always loved seeing the Tree of Life in art, from Gustav Klimt to jewelry, and a multitude of interpretations in between. Yet I struggle to find my own unique connection with the Tree of Life. However, doing research for this episode has been inspiring. I love learning about the many ways the Tree of Life has been a part of cultures and civilizations. It all shows me that there are many access points to connecting with the Tree of Life. Maybe I simply need to broaden my view. All trees give life. Without trees, there would be no human beings. We are in a deep relationship with one another. I constantly learn from trees and receive sustenance, knowledge, and health and inspiration. This week, we are celebrating another powerful force of creation, love, and sustenance, mothers. In honor of the upcoming Mother's Day, my producer Jonathan and I have asked our mothers to share a sapling or short tree-related story of their very own. We take this time to honor our own mothers and the mother figures around us, extending this biological definition out to cover anyone who has brought something to life and or who fosters the growth of another. To be a mother can take many forms, even that of a mother tree, and we pay tribute to you all. Now here is Miriam, Anne-Marie, and Jackie.
Our apartment building was built in Holon near an already established neighborhood. It was beautiful. It was all one story with a big front yard. And my pediatrician lived in one of these houses. And I could go to her without my parents because it was two or three streets over, no traffic. There weren't many cars back then. And I went to the pediatrician, and whenever she had to give us a shot or do something that would be mildly painful, she felt so badly. And she was a very practical woman. You know, she spoke to the point, not spoiling you in any way, but she felt so badly after giving you a shot that she would walk you out to the front yard on your way home and pick a mango from her mango tree and give it to you as a prize to bring home. And mango trees were very rare back then, so it was always a treat. So actually, before it transformed, on the way to school, I walked to on paved road for the most part until I got to an area where it was dunes again, and I had to cross the dunes to get to school. And in the middle of the dunes were a sycamore tree. And it was the most wonderful tree because it had very strong branches, low enough for us to climb on and then climb higher and higher. It was halfway to the school, and that's where we had all our meetings. From second grade to eighth grade, our socializing was in this sycamore tree. And then when they continued building the city around and they built on the dunes, luckily they preserved the tree. They built a little rotary for the cars to go around it, and it's still there.
It's a beautiful spring morning in San Diego, California, and I'm sitting under our enormous pine tree in what we call the lower 40 in our big backyard. The lowest branch is bedecked with a red sleeve of bougainvillea, perfect for the person this grand tree is named for, Grandma Margaret. Not truly our children's grandmother, Margaret was everything I could have hoped for, kind, generous, and loving, and was the perfect surrogate for my mother who had recently passed. She came to our home each Tuesday morning so that I could run errands and enjoy a cup of coffee after, calling it our little bargain. This went on for several years until Grandma Margaret's wonderful and generous spirit fell victim to the cruelty of Alzheimer's. On one of our last visits during Christmas time, her daughter gave us a small living pine tree from the supermarket. Little did we know that once this small tree took root, it would take over an entire corner, providing shelter and shade. Grandma Margaret's tree is a testament to her beauty, tenacity, strength, and faith. Happy Mother's Day, Grandma Margaret.
I've always had an affinity for trees. Tree blossoms in spring, summer shade trees, trees in rich fall colors, and holiday fir trees. By writing an essay on the apple trees in our yard and what they meant to me when I was a third grader, I won an evergreen tree from a local nursery, and my class was invited to our house to see the tree planted. It was an exciting event. Many years later, as an elementary music educator, I continued to share a love for trees through song and poetry, such as Kilmer's famous poem, Trees. Kindergartners sang Mr. Rogers' tree song, and older students learned about the redwoods through Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land, to name just a few of the opportunities I had for incorporating trees into music curriculum. Before we built a home 35 years ago, my husband planted hundreds of evergreen trees and hauled water for their survival prior to there being an available water source on the land. We added beloved birch trees, and when I planted another favorite, a willow, in the absence of rope to stake it, I had to use what was on hand, speaker wire, which somehow seemed apropos for a music teacher. Today, that tree soars 40 feet in the air, and the wind still sings a sweet melody through its willowy branches. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thank you for joining Tree Speech today.